The Defense Department has to look past the current budget struggles and try to see the future, the long-term future. Paul Shari is director of the 20YY Warfare Initiative at the Center for a New American Security, a former Army Ranger and Pentagon expert on unmanned systems. He's done a lot of thinking about long-term military affairs. He joins me now with a look beyond 2016. Paul, good morning. Great to have you on.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right, tell us about the 20YY program and how it got its name.
Sure. So the 20YY Warfare Initiative was started by now Deputy Secretary Robert Work when he was at the Center for New American Security as our CEO a little over a year ago. And it was intended to harken back to a program called 20XX that was run by Andy Marshall out of the Office of Net Assessment in the late 1990s and early 2000s that also looked several decades out and laid the foundations intellectually for programs like the long-range bomber today. There were some things I also didn't get right, but it was intended to be sort of an update to that, now looking out, again, several decades in the future to see what's coming next.
Okay, I thought it might be YY sequestration, but okay, now we understand a little bit better.
Yep.
Now, I heard you speak the other day briefly about planning new aircraft carriers, which they have to do, I guess, at some point, and how they will fit into the world, you said, of 2070. Because that's how long these ships would be deployed after they're built, and, you know, presumably 20 years from now. So how is it possible to model anything out that far?
Well, it's not. It's the short answer. I mean, the timelines the Department of Defense has to plan on are staggering. So the Department of Defense will start laying the keel today, this year, for an aircraft carrier that will be in the fleet until 2072. That's incredible when you think about the potential for war to change over that time frame. And so, you know, it's trying to envision what war might be fought like in the 2050s or 60s or 70s is just mind-boggling. And so it really forces you to start thinking about modular design, about ways that you can make systems that are adaptable over time and can be upgraded. And, of course, the carrier itself is really designed that way in the sense that the carrier is basically a truck. It carries aircraft, and the aircraft are what bring the combat power. And the aircraft are intended to evolve over time. The aircraft we have today will not be the aircraft in 2070. But we do have to make sure that we are evolving those aircraft to meet the needs of the time.
Because Navy people like to say, well, when the enemy sees the outline of a carrier, that makes them kind of quake in their boots. And it is an impressive sight. But you know, some other areas you've been working on and some articles I've read recently talk about swarms of autonomous, not just unmanned, but autonomous vehicles in the air that could swarm over a carrier and make it irrelevant almost.
That's right. That's right. And so the Navy tested this year a laser weapon system out in the Arabian Gulf that could be used as a cost-effective means of shooting down cheap drones. And the problem with the large numbers of cheap drones isn't that you can't shoot them down. It's that shooting down a $1,000 drone with a $1 million missile is not really a winning proposition. You can't do that too many times before you're out of missiles, and they've still got more drones coming at you. So the Navy's investing in things like laser weapons. Machine guns also work and are quite effective and cost-effective, too, as ways to shoot down cheap drones. But it's certainly something that's coming. It was just last month somebody crashed a small drone on the White House lawn. The technology is widely available. Building big combat aircraft, unmanned aircraft, will be hard, but just about anyone will be able to get their hands on large numbers of cheap drones. Just this week, we heard that the United States shot down a drone by ISIS in the Middle East. Now, that's not a Reaper-type aircraft, but it's small and probably not very capable, but it's out there.
All right, and the Air Force is looking at the so-called sixth-generation fighter. I think there's a little piece of the budget even coming up to explore what that might look like. And they're also talking about a new bomber that they might build 100 of. And so how can they think about these platforms? They can't possibly expect them to be all piloted, can they?
Well, that's going to be one of the fundamental questions. Now, when you scale up to something the size of a bomber, the advantages of taking a person out become less valuable because the size and weight that you're using for the person in the cockpit become more marginal in terms of the size of the aircraft. Because the bomber's big enough, you can have two crews, so you can swap crews out. But for a fighter-sized aircraft, you get a number of advantages. You get about a 7 to 10% increase in endurance by taking the person in the cockpit out, replacing that with gas. But more importantly, you no longer tie the aircraft to the limits of human endurance. So you can keep the aircraft up for days at a time with aero refueling, and that allows you to project a lot more power forward in the fight. But that's a big cultural hurdle to get there. The Air Force is doing it for surveillance aircraft, but the idea of having unmanned combat aircraft makes people very uneasy. And the Air Force has talked a lot about next-generation unmanned aircraft, but they don't have any money in the budget for it. So I think that's going to be a big conceptual leap forward.
Paul Shari is the director of the 20YY Warfare Initiative at the Center for New American Security. And this idea of autonomy comes up a lot. You yourself have written about it and worked on it during your Pentagon years. What exactly is autonomy versus unmanned, and what advantages does it bring, and what dangers does it bring?
Sure. So I think the way to think about it is to look at, say, how we're seeing cars evolve. It used to be you had to drive a car all the time with your hands on the wheel. Now we're seeing technologies incorporate gradually, things like automatic lane keeping, collision avoidance, intelligent cruise control that makes the car more automated. And at some point in time the road, and people can maybe have different views on when this will happen, but you can envision cars where you take your hands off the wheel, or like the Google car, there is no steering wheel. So I think similarly, if we have people physically piloting aircraft or ground vehicles or tanks 30 years from now, we're probably doing it wrong. Those are functions that should be automated, but the person's still in command of the vehicle and making decisions about the mission. Just like you wouldn't get in a car and ask the car, where should I go? You tell the car, the self-driving car, where you want to go, and the car gets you there. So there are certainly some functions that a person needs to do. So I think it's really about a blend of what the machine does and what the person does, and figure out what's the right mix.
And with all this possibility of different technological futures, which the military's got to think about, it also has to be overlaid with what the world itself will be like. And I don't think anyone could have predicted that the so-called Arab Spring would descend into what it has descended into. Sometimes wishful thinking is the biggest danger to foreign policy. So how does the look at the world that's going to be out there overlay with all of this technological planning?
Sure. A couple big things that I think are worth keeping in mind. One is the scale of the information revolution that we're living in the midst of. Last year, total spending globally on information technology was $3.8 trillion a year, which was more than double all military spending by all militaries around the globe on everything that militaries work on, research and development, procurement, personnel. So there's a lot of investments in information technology. We're going to continue to see that evolve over time. Even if Moore's laws, we're beginning to see that it soon begins to sort of start tapering off. Not stop, but starts to slow sort of the pace of microprocessor advancement. We'll still see major advances, but I think one of the most significant ones is the social implications of that. As we see billions of more people come online, we're seeing a transformation in how people communicate on par with the development of the printing press, in terms of the democratization of information and the spread of technology, and the ability for anyone to get online and spread their message out, and the way that changes the relationship between people and authority. So when you think about that in conflict, how would we do, say, an evacuation operation of an embassy or U.S. citizens in a place like Cairo, where the population is digitized and mobilized, and they're able to get out in the street and film U.S. service members and every action they do and report on them, and flash mobs can get in the way. That's a very different kind of environment than we've been fighting in the last, the decade or so or more in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's something that I think is going to be difficult to prepare for.
And you were an Army Ranger, and you went to sniper school, so you were either on the ground or maybe in a tree. I'm not sure which. But how does that experience inform your thinking about the future?
Well, I think it informs to me a lot of humility about what technology can do. So there is a lot of the Department of Defense loves technology. We have a lot of exciting high-tech things like stealth, aircraft that have given the U.S. a lot of advantages. But one of the things that we learned, and then I certainly learned this personally on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that sometimes it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't add up. It doesn't help. And, we were in a situation where we had all of this amazing technology, and there were people, wearing flip-flops and pajamas carrying an AK-47 that had effective parity with us, that all of the technology we had didn't really make enough of a difference on the ground. Part of that has to do with the fact that the barrier to entry on the ground for war is very low, right? Someone can come out of the back of their mud hut and they can grab their AK-47 and they can use some fertilizer to assemble a bomb, and they're in the fight. They don't need a stealth aircraft to do that. But I think it really just, you know, sort of helps remind me that you need to look at what the other side's going to do too. There's been a lot of talk in the last 20 years in the U.S. military about things like information dominance and things that sort of forget that the other side gets to fight too. They get a vote. They're not going to, you know, wait and sit back and wait for the U.S. to evolve and not respond on their own.
Paul Shari is director of the 20YY Warfare Initiative at the Center for a New American Security. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.